For dinner. What's for dinner? What's for dinner? Talking about what's ever on their minds. Talking about what's ever on their minds.
All right, here we go. We're going. We're recording. Thanks. Welcome.
Yes, Flip, thank you for having me, man.
Oh,
it's good to be here.
Thanks for being had.
Oh.
Hey.
We are, we're coming at you live from a... Have you ever done this from a library?
No, this is my first library. Let me welcome everybody now to this show. I believe we're close to 100 shows.
Are you really?
You're in the upper 90s right
now.
Oh,
sweet. I'll take it.
I think you're number 98.
Nice.
If I'm not mistaken. If I am mistaken, then forgive me. Welcome to the show, guys. Coming to you from the library aboard the Norwegian Getaway, where myself and my guest, comedian Patrick Keane, have been sailing for, not really sailing, we've been on the boat for about 8 days or so with another comic. And we are now en route to Nassau, Bahamas.
And this is both of our first cruise ships.
Yeah. This is my, well... Technically, I did
performing.
I've been on many cruises, but this is the technically my first time being hired specifically by a cruise line. I did perform on a KISS fan cruise.
That's incredible.
Which, yeah, it was fun.
That's fantastic.
But I was hired. I was asked to perform by. Do you know Craig Gass?
I know that name. Why do I know that name? He's been around comedy a long time.
Yeah, a really well-known comic. He was on Stern a lot, does impressions of like KISS guys.
Yeah, I definitely know the name. Yeah.
Yeah, he asked me to open for him. Didn't make any money doing it. Just got a free cruise and got to meet KISS. So it was definitely
not bad.
Worth it. So, but yeah, this is my first official time on a cruise ship being hired by the cruise line, making money on the cruise.
Wow.
And yours too, right?
Yeah, first time on a cruise.
But this
first time
first
performing
time
on a cruise. Yeah. So the whole thing's been new. We came over from Europe to New York, where we met you, and the whole thing's been a trip.
I think this is probably the most abnormal kind of cruise to perform on this, because this is the inaugural cruise of this ship, literally a brand new ship. We're the first guys performing comedy on it.
Maiden voyage. Made in Norway and then shipped over.
We are the
first show here. And it's been fun. It's been a learning experience. The shows are one thing, but the experience overall has been excellent. You know, it's been A, so I appreciate that. So
explain now. You and two other comics.
It was myself and two others got on the ship in England, in Southampton, where it had come from Norway, and it was 10 days to get from Southampton to New York. And we had a couple shows a night, every night. And then that's where we met you. The other two comics flew home. You and Ralph came in.
Ralph Harris.
And we've been working with you guys for the last few days. And then we all leave in a couple days again for the new batch.
It was very weird, though, because normally how a cruise would work is you'd come onto the ship, and the ship would set sail to a destination over a period of days and then come back to port and then recycle the passengers. But because this is maiden voyage, and we just had the Super Bowl, which should give you an idea of when this is recorded, we were actually docked in New York for like 5 days. So this cruise ship was essentially a hotel for 5 days.
In a pretty good part of the town.
We were
88. We were right by Central Park.
Right off Times Square. It was pretty amazing. But it was freezing. My God, was it freezing?
Yeah, it's good to be here as we head towards the South Atlantic.
Yes, so very relieved. And we were, like I said, docked there for like 5 days. And I was just vamping because literally we've had this library to ourselves. Like no one has been here.
Oh, right.
Literally, within 2 minutes of us starting, somebody walks in. We're like, well, fuck.
Right. People, man.
People have no respect for microphones.
It's unbelievable.
They really don't. So, we were like docked for 5 days, and it didn't even feel like we were on a cruise at that point. It just felt like we were
weirdly in the Navy.
We
were more
in
New York
than
we were on the ship. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very strange. And the shows have been very abnormal too, because again, normally this place holds like the ship has a capacity of like 4,000 passengers.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's correct.
Not counting crew, just
correct.
Passengers. And I think the first 2 days we were in New York, we had packed shows because it was pretty much like they opened this ship for travel agents to come on and look at the ship. Beautiful ship, by the way. So the both shows were packed. But since then, our biggest show, I think, before we started setting sail yesterday, was like 14 people.
Yep. Yeah, smallest the theater where we have stand-up, it can hold 200, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a club. It actually is a comedy club on
it's
the show.
Built ready. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
for a
it
club.
Really is. It's on land, it would be a great club on its own. But yeah, we have had such small audiences, some of which were very nice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the smallest ones could be good, could be the best, pardon me. But it feels like we're performing at a shitty one-nighter.
Yeah.
Not based on the club, it's just based on the capacity of the crowds.
Right.
So what sucks is like you and I and Ralph are getting off in a couple of days in Miami, and we're with the exception of those first two nights, we're not going to really know what this club is capable of.
Yeah,
which is kind of disappointing.
Yeah, it is, because those were fun. Those were a little bit of a rush to finally have those, and we're not going to taste that again probably. I don't know. It's funny that the crowds are so nonspecific. The great thing about a one-nighter in stand-up is that, no, good or bad, you get to leave and drive away afterwards.
Yeah.
And a cruise ship, it doesn't go well. You see these people on the ship. And some of them might come back. Even if it doesn't go well, they come back. And it's like, what are you coming back for? And just morbid curiosity to see a comic either flail through or do the same jokes, and then they comment on that. And it's like, man, there's 10 other things to do at this, you know, time slot on the ship.
You know what's funny? Like, I think, because this is, like you said, it's your first time on a cruise ship, but obviously performing on a cruise, and my first time officially performing on a cruise. And, but having been a passenger on many cruises, comedy seems to be one of the more popular things to do.
It's so crazy.
Because it really is this, because you can go see, like, we saw the Latin Ballroom show last night called Burn the Floor, which was amazing. But you see that once, and it's like, okay, that's what they do.
Right.
It's fantastic, but it's never going to veer off that formulaic show. And same with if you see the magic show, or you see the musical, or if you see whatever. Comedy seems to be that one show that is very personal, that is flexible, that can change based on a comment somebody says, or something that might have happened that day, or blah, 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 blah. And I think people, like you said, there's that morbid curiosity. Either is this person going to suck again, or, you know, this could be a completely different kind of show. So, and I think that's like one of the really appealing things about seeing a comedy show on a cruise, which is, I think, why we, you know, it does get, like, even when we
the
have
opposite.
A small,
it's unexpected. Whereas these other shows, you know what you're going to go see.
Are just, again, formulaic. They're scripted. I think that's the appeal of a comedy show. Especially on a ship, when you're, like you said, you're kind of trapped. I hate saying trapped, but you're confined.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is.
You can't, you know, you can go off the ship, but it's not going to be a good trip. And so I think, you know, with all things considered, comedy is that one one entertainment that has the flexibility to change.
Yeah, it's part, the cruise ship, I think, in general, is part dormitory, part prison, really. I mean, it's
really
great, yeah, and...
That's what I hear is a trap. Like, do you know a lot of cruise comics?
No, just I know Ralph now, and then I know Daryl Joyce, but both those guys work clubs as well. I don't know any exclusive cruise ship comics, but
because I've heard, like, just talking to a few over my career, that the cruises have that appeal because the money is great, but you get trapped. Because the money's so great.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one thing that I told myself when I got this offer. Like, I'm not going to do more than 4 or 5 a year just for that reason alone.
Right.
But I wondered if, like, if you had spoken to any of them, just what their, like...
Right, what their dilemma is, or what their cutoff is, or if they've just signed off completely. And just do cruise ships now. Well, I know Jeff Jenna does a lot of cruise ships. I don't see his name in the club scene so much anymore. He's out of Cincy. He used to be in Irvine. And
Jeff Jenna
does mostly cruise ships now, I think. You know, he's got the wife and child, and maybe he just likes that, because then he can go home and play golf when he wants. I know he does corporate gigs as well, but
there is an appeal to it, but and this is going to sound awful, and I don't mean for it the way it sounds, but it almost seems like guys that kind of can reside to doing mainly cruise ships and some corporates are those guys that have kind of in their career said, all right, you know what, I've giving it my best shot. I'm not going to reach that level that, you know, everybody aspires to. Most people aspire to when they get in the business. I'm fine just settling here, for lack of a better term.
Making a living,
And you know, a pretty good living. But, you know, I mean, let's just call a spade. We get in this business to try to reach that level of success that only a few are able to.
Yeah, you know? We all want that. Yeah. The sitcom, the show, the movies.
Exactly. And I think it's a, I don't know if, you know, you think about it both ways. Is it a tough pill to swallow to go, okay, that's not going to happen, but I'm good here? Or is it almost a relief to go, you know what, I've given it my best shot. I'm tired of trying to reach for that. I'm very happy here.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm curious what way some of those guys feel about it.
Yeah, it's such a funny thing. I mean, if you've got the family and the children, then it's probably, whoa, I gotta, like, this paycheck is nice. Forget my aspirations, my dreams, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to think like a businessman here. But as a, you know, you're a married guy, no children. I'm a single guy, no children. So we dabble in this and then still have the dream.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm sure there is some nice, okay, I'm making a living. But there's still that kind of stigma for a cruise ship comic that you want to avoid. Yeah,
there really is. Like,
and a lot of managers will advise against their clients doing it, even if they're broke. It's like, no, don't do it. But this could pay my bills for the rest of the year or something. Like, yeah, but you'll be thrown in that category. And it's like, oh wow, this is a tough.
It's a tough choice to
make. Yeah.
Like what you got. You said you got in. You started doing comedy in 2000.
2000, yeah.
So in you're hitting
Orange
about
County
13
and I
years.
Moved up to LA. Yeah, I'm hitting about 13 years now. And
what brought you into it?
You know, in college, I always wanted to write. I was always writing, even in high school, just kind of, oh, this would be a good idea. I always loved movies. I didn't necessarily love stand up, and I would write funny, or what I thought was funny. This would be a funny scene in a movie or a TV show or a sitcom or something. And then I just compiled a bunch of them over 4 years in college and then wrote this screenplay with all my buddies playing the characters. And it never went anywhere, but I liked the idea of a script, a format. You know, I loved all the 80s movies. Mm-hmm. And because I think that was the golden age of comedy.
Oh,
movies.
Don't even get me started on that. We'll do 80s movies in a minute.
Yeah. And so I was always into that more so. And then so to get seen or discovered, I was like, oh, maybe I'll get seen as a comic or an actor, and then people will read my screenplays at some point. But stand-up never went bad enough for me to stop, you know? It was never, as horrible as we've all experienced gigs, it never was bad enough that I was like, okay, I'm done with this. So I kind of stayed in that, and then I still, you know, will dabble in a screenplay here and there and constantly rework one or something and try to sell one. And
have you sold any?
No, nothing. Stuff's out there to being looked at, and some writing samples and pilots and stuff. But I still do the stand up because it's rewarding enough, and it's kind of the living now. And then the dream, I think, from this point is, you know, making it in stand up, but also getting into film a little bit. You know,
so would you see stand up as more of a gateway into
a
bigger
thing?
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah.
So let's say if you got all the stars align and you get a cast on a big show and you get some scripts made and everything, would you go back to stand up or would you kind of?
Not necessarily. No, not unless I needed to, because I would like to. I started in L.A. I'd like to be out in L.A., you know, working on TV shows or movies and little situation, you know, Woody Allen-esque.
You want to molest your daughter?
Right, exactly. You know, whatever race.
Allegedly, by the way, allegedly.
Allegedly. I would wait, though, until she wasn't a minor. So I don't know if it's still constituted as molesting if they're after 18. But they wouldn't be my blood. Whole separate podcast there. But, you know, combining the character, like I'd play myself. I can't act, but I'd play myself and stuff, or just I'd like to be able to cast it with a good mix of comics, good mix of actors. I think it'd be fun. I don't need to be on camera, you know.
Was Woody like one of your inspirations?
Yeah, a little bit. And now this is all very disheartening, all this stuff that's coming out you know. And the cover-ups, too, make you sick.
I know. It's not our business. You know, unfortunately, he's a public figure, and there are tabloids that are going to be using it as, you know, fodder for sales and whatever. But it's such a private matter. I feel almost embarrassed and ashamed to even talk about it. But I really hope it wasn't true.
Yeah, it's the best you can hope for.
Yeah, I love Woody Allen, and that would just, if it came out that it was true, it would just totally, it would,
God.
It's the same thing with Michael Jackson.
Yeah, like, Michael Jackson, yeah.
People, you know, he was an amazing musician, an amazing performer, an amazing, you know, humanitarian, and then all the allegations that came out, and the cover-up, and the payoffs, and then when he died, all the drug abuse and everything, it's like his talent is almost starting to get a little overshadowed
which
by the
crazy.
Controversy, which is sad, you know? So yeah, I'm totally hoping that this Woody Allen thing, again, not my business, but I'm just praying it's not true.
Yeah,
you know,
too.
What's your favorite Woody Allen movie?
You know what I like, which is one that he's not in, is Bullets Over Broadway, because
never
it's just, it's his voice, clearly, he wrote it. John Cusack plays kind of the Woody Allen character.
Okay.
Takes place in like the 1920s, roaring 20s in New York, or obviously. And it's just, it combines all great things like New York, Woody Allen, that time period, and gangster mixed with the theater.
Really?
It's great. It's going to be a musical.
Yeah, I saw them. They actually already have it. I saw Marquee about it when we were in New York.
Yeah. So,
and what's your name? Diane?
Yes, I know that first name. The second name escapes me.
Wait,
as well.
Hold on. Diane Wiest.
Oh, is she in it?
She won the Oscar for it.
Oh, the movie. Yeah, she did. Yeah, she's fantastic in it. Yeah, Tracy Ullman's in it. One of the Tillies. I don't know which. She's fantastic. Jack Warden, the great guy who was always a great second lead. But yeah, you should see it. You should see it. I like Manhattan and Annie Hall as well. But
just saw Annie Hall for the first time.
Oh, did you really?
Past year, yeah.
Oh, man, yeah.
I guess when it came out, it was more of this kind of like breakthrough idea as far as like just a movie about just a relationship. Like, and I guess since then there have been so many that seeing it now. After being exposed to everything else, I get it. I get Diane Keaton's charm and everything in it. But I don't know, for whatever reason, it didn't hit me as hard as I guess it did when a lot of people saw it for the first time.
That makes sense. I'd be interested in, like, if someone saw Pulp Fiction for the first time today.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Or something. Or The Office, the original English Office. Yeah. That's another influence. I love Ricky Gervais and the original Office.
Oh.
It's just because that's a guy that was probably, I don't know if he's a mediocre stand-up or a bad one or a great one. I have no idea. But he brought this concept to life. And it's amazing. That's the kind of stuff I like. A little bit more than just the hardcore, just straight stand-up. You know what I'm saying?
So, like, the... Because I'll be honest, I never saw either Office.
Oh, you didn't?
English
okay.
or American.
Yeah, the English is really good. You know, the American, I didn't think it had a chance, but I think Greg Daniels is the guy that did it, and they actually did a great job. Clearly, it worked for many years, but I just still didn't care for the idea that we just took an English idea and remade it.
Well, they've been doing it for years. All in the Family.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, talk about pushing boundaries the time that came out. Norman Lear... You know, as far as they covered rape. Do you remember that episode?
Yeah.
Edith Bunker almost got raped.
That's right. Who?
Edith Bunker.
Where was that? Queens or something? Where did I think it took place in Queens. The show. I don't know where she got almost raped though.
It was at some stranger knocked on the door, forced himself in, and almost had his way with Edith.
Oh my God!
And it's just so you watch that episode. It's like it's almost funny. I hate saying it because it's like. You're gonna rape Edith Bunker, but at the same time, Gene Stapleton played that character so innocently that you're like, "Oh God, no!"
God, they tackled issues that show, man.
Racism,
right? Yeah, like, I remember the race, the Jefferson thing, and
then
there was an episode Israel Palestine. The car blew up on the street down the street. Somebody died. Oh, it was crazy.
Really?
Man. Yeah.
But I mean that was based on an English show.
That's amazing. Yeah. Was it called All in the Family as well, or something?
God, I forgot what it was called. I forgot the name.
So another straight lift.
Okay. But I mean, a lot of great shows were lifted from English shows.
Yeah.
So I think British comedy is very, very, what's the word? I'm thinking subversive, but that's not the word. Like, it's just original, for lack of a better term, that many people borrow from it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at, Monty Python.
Oh,
I'm not sure if
God.
You're a Python
fan. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. There's a book right behind us here.
Oh, is there?
It's if you can see it on the
Right. Flying Circus. Loved Monty Python.
Yeah, they're amazing. So they're such original stuff that naturally stuff's going to get borrowed from them because people can't go deeper than that, right?
Than British comedy or Monty Python?
British original humor.
Well, it's
where English started, I guess.
I was going to say, if you really want to get technical, America was founded by... You know, British people. So I'm sure a lot of the, you know, the taste in the blanking on words
here? It's derived
here?
From that.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
That's our core, our like genesis.
Yeah, exactly. Like even if you go back to court jesters, I'm sure had some stuff that modern day comics borrowed. Like,
yeah,
court jesters use. My liege, have you ever noticed the way that people eat mead?
Right. You yeah, know? And he's there, and he's the only one telling the king the truth, right?
Yeah.
But that's like we were talking about starting in L.A. as opposed to starting like. I think if you start in New York, mm-hmm. then it's stand up. There's some structure. You're like, okay, you and I have been in L.A. so long. It's like not only do you need to excel or try to excel at stand up, you need to hear the idea of packaging yourself and creating a show around yourself and commercial auditions and all this stuff. So that by the end of the day, you're like, oh, I didn't even write any stand up today.
Right.
You know, I'm so worried about where I could fit a show around myself. So you think kind of conceptually more in L.A. than in New York.
Absolutely. I think we'll see, like, because you said you started in L.A. and then we were earlier before the podcast, Patrick, myself and Ralph were having a bite and the discussion about starting in L.A. and or New York is just it's not good for a comic because there's no way to really kind of develop your own style because you're so engrossed in a specific L.A., New York, or even like Chicago or Houston, Dallas style. Like they all kind of have their own things. And if you're starting in there, you're like, I remember I was working years ago in Texas and so many guys were trying to be Hicks.
Were they?
Trying to be Bill Hicks, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's who came out of that and that's who they saw kind of succeed and they felt like,
God,
oh,
that's so funny that they're trying to do that because like Bill Hicks and Richard Pryor and those guys, they started funny and then got edgy.
Right.
And a lot of these people are trying to start edgy
which
you need the funny first.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Like if you look at early Pryor and early Carlin and early Lenny Bruce, it was very silly. Carlin especially, like Hippy Dippy Weatherman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Very character driven, very silly. And then over, you know, through his experience and then the political scene of the 60s or whatever, they started, you know, becoming more of a truth teller and like really going with
insightful their own experiences.
What was inside of them. Yeah.
God, that's amazing. Yeah.
And like, I started in Florida and it was a very blank palette. So I was influenced by some guys over my first couple of years out there, but I started kind of developing my own thing over a couple of years. Then when I got to LA, I brought what I already had there.
Yeah.
And I might've been influenced a little when I got there, but I stayed kind of, luckily I was able to stay true to what I learned on the road. That's the other thing. Like when you start on the road, you also learn how to handle rooms, different kinds of rooms, different kinds of crowds. Whereas in LA, again, you're kind of generally playing to one specific kind of audience.
Yeah,
did you find that?
Yeah. I think in LA you're writing from the outside in. I've heard a couple of people kind of say that.
That's a good way to say
it. And that's what it feels like is, this isn't, you know, you write this stuff that, these people like this. This is marketable. This will appeal to as many people as, instead of writing for, from the soul. And I don't know, who are people lifting now? Like, when you started, it was Hicks, but now are people trying to be Mitch or Dane, or is that faded and people are trying to be Louis C.K. now?
Dane, there was a while that a lot of people were trying to be Dane, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's still some. Because, I mean, you got to think to the guys coming up now, Dane
is
Carlin.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if CK or Stanhope.
Stanhope, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Those are big ones.
Yeah. Or Tosh.
Tosh, sure. Yeah. That would make sense.
Yeah, it's again, it's like when I was first starting out, I was looking at guys like Robin Williams and Steve Martin were kind of like who I was aspiring to be. So I was very animated, very silly. And then, you know, again, over time, you develop your own voice, whatever. Like you said, like Woody Allen.
I like that reflective stuff. I always liked Seinfeld, but, I was guilty of liking the show. So I was like, oh, his stand-up, to me, stand-up was those venues that he's playing as the intro to the show. I'm like, oh, these clever small rooms, brick coffee shop. He's got the nice little situation. People are listening. I'm like, oh, I can write for that. And then you go to your first open mic, and it's like a bar, and there's pool being played right next to the stage, and it's like, oh, I have to yell, I have to talk about sex, I have to talk about being drunk, I have to talk about marijuana, and I don't know, and then you kind of use those as crutches, and then you go play a real room, full house, and it's like, oh, these people are actually listening,
yeah,
but I don't have that arsenal because I've been wasting my time in bars.
That's, again, back to the downside of starting in LA. Yeah. Well, who would you say, like, so was it signed, so was it, did you have any stand-up influence, or was it just more like you kind of fell into it from the writing?
Yeah, I kind of fell into it from the writing, but, you know, I like Louis C.K. Seinfeld and Rock, I still like, maybe that's old school for someone who's not, but the Rock makes it a rock, like a concert. Like, he is on that stage. He's moving. He's tackling
big issues.
Oh, he's a tiger,
man. He's prowling. Like, Rock never stands still. If you notice that, he's always pacing back and forth. I see him like a tiger behind a cage, just watching the audience and back and forth and back and forth.
Oh, man. And it's great, right? It's like and he comes out to big music. And then you have Louis C.K. that comes out to nothing and just grabs the mic and says, hey, okay, no intro, no opening act.
Carl is the same way.
Yeah.
Like, I got to open for Carl in a couple times.
Oh, Jesus, that's crazy.
And yeah, it was insane. And the way it worked when I worked with him was like, you know, I'd go out, do 10. His normal opener would do 20, intermission. Then Carl would come out. But literally, there was no fanfare. There was no music. It was just, he's backstage. He's like, all right, I'm ready. Lights go down. He walks out. That's it.
Wow.
You know, he did just coming out blank and just taking it from there.
Oh, my God, man.
Coming out at zero, and that's...
Beautiful.
It's beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
Not a lot of guys can do that. Like you said, CK does it.
Yeah.
You know, I think Stanhope does it.
Actually, yeah,
he should
great.
Do it. I'm not surprised if he...
You know who I like? What did I hear? Oh, when Ozzy was on Howard Stern, and Stern's like, who's your influence? And... Ozzy said it was the Beatles. I mean, he wanted to be the Beatles, and he evolves into this entirely different act than what the Beatles were. And it's just funny that people's influence, it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, you start with liking somebody, then you get into it. And then I think the first person I saw live that right away I was like, this guy's amazing, is Zach
Galifianakis
on the piano at the Improv one night. And, you know, nobody was there. And I was like, oh my, I was dying. I was like, oh my God. And just one of those acts that you connect with. And, you know, I think we all have a few that we love. And with the piano and the one-liners and just the flippancy of just not caring. And Brody Stevens is another one that I could watch both those guys go for hours.
Yeah.
You know, I think I can't watch a lot of the talking heads that a lot of people love, where it's just, to me, it's talking, talking, talking. And they have a lot of TV appearances, and I'm like, that's great, but I don't know. You want some kind of reaction from the audience, even if it's not a positive one.
Yeah.
You don't want to just tell them, oh, that was interesting. Yeah, that was a good set. That was funny. You want people kind of walking off going, what the hell?
What the fuck was
that? What are they doing, man?
Yeah.
Like, some of the looks on the audience members of a Brody Stevens crowd, it's just, you're laughing. You know, the comics in the back love it.
It's definitely to the back of the room kind of comic.
And
have you seen his
Comedy Central show? Yeah,
yeah.
It's crazy. It's
and
fantastic.
It's really insightful.
Yeah.
And then that's very much Brody, too. Like, I've had conversations with him where he's, like, I remember he was getting some kind of laser surgery, and the doctor slipped or something, and he had, a little scar.
Okay.
From, like, the surgery, and he's just like, can you see the scar? I'm so, God, this fucking scar. I keep seeing this fucking scar.
Oh, God, he's
like so paranoid and so, what's the word?
Yeah, very, very, I don't know, not anal retentive,
neurotic.
But neurotic.
Neurotic.
Yeah.
And, but then you put a camera in front of it and it's entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. He deserves it too. He's been around forever.
Oh, he's fantastic. And the thing is, he can write, as Evan says, I've got the jokes, people. I've got the joke. And he does have, you know, a million jokes.
Yeah.
But it's also him delivering the joke, him talking about the joke, him, the cadence of his day. Like, look, I sat, you know, on a very nice chair today at, you know, Office Depot thinking about getting it. All right. It's $14.99, you know, normally $20. I mean, just the dumbest little details of life. And he even says it too. He's like, look, people don't get Brody. I don't get Brody. And that is just so funny. What you have on that show is a guy who doesn't even understand himself.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
We can all relate to that.
I was going to say, a lot of, I think a lot of us that go into this are damaged in some way.
Yeah.
You know, like I forgot who said it, but they nailed it saying, what kind of person goes into a profession where they need love and adoration from strangers? It's true.
Yeah. Like, I don't know.
I don't know. Like, I know. Like, I did. I don't know about you. Like, I didn't have a bad childhood.
Yeah.
My parents are still together.
Yeah. Same.
You know, got brought up great. I've had, you know, heartbreak in my life. Who hasn't?
Right.
You know, but I've never had a drinking problem. Never had a drug addiction. I just like making people laugh.
Yeah.
But I won't lie, there is that part of me that's like, oh, like last night, the show was eh. It wasn't, I didn't bomb, but
to
it
you
was
it was
eh.
To a comic it was eh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to the crowd, they seemed like somebody had stopped us last night and said, great show. But there's that part of me that's like, oh, but I didn't get the love I'm used to getting, so I'm a failure. Mm-hmm. And that's just a comic, like, neuroses right there.
Yeah.
And, like, didn't you said yourself you didn't have a bad childhood?
No, no, didn't. It was great. A lot of love, you know, four kids, private school. Moved around a lot, so I had to, like, whatever, make friends. So we were never grounded.
Where it might come from?
Maybe that.
The desire to constantly make friends and be accepted?
Yeah. I think that's part of it.
Are any of your brothers and sisters in this field?
No. My brother was in sports. Now he's in, like, property management. My sister's in physical training. Yeah, they're not even close to it. My mom was big arts, musicals, singing.
Okay.
She played piano and guitar a little bit.
So you had that artistic influence.
Very little, because my dad was huge sports, and he ran the day. So it was like a lot of sports. I think
a lot of this is genetic.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I think so too. To perform, to want to be up, and it's so funny that we even have, like, why is there this weird stigma about performing? I don't know if you feel it, but like, part like, oh, I'm ashamed that I want to get up and do this in front of people. I want to connect, whether it's laughter or theater or acting or whatever. And it's like, why is that shameful in some pockets of society? Like, I think conservative society looks at it and says, why do you want to be like, why wouldn't you just get into banking or insurance or, you know, back in the 90s, .com. And it's like, well, who cares? I want to, like, perform. I mean, you know, I'm not a flamboyant gay kid that wants to sing. I just, you know, I'd like to do jokes. I like to, like you said, make people laugh. And I don't know. James Thurber, I love this quote. I have it on the Twitter. It says, what is it? Comedy is emotional chaos remembered in tranquility. And
like
it's
that.
Just us trying to, it's like we're trying to connect with the rest of the world, and this is the only way
that we
can
how.
Do it. Yeah, because we're bored by your normal conversations, humanity, if you're out there. and so we're, like, mixing it up and, you know, trying to trigger some goofy thought, feeling, emotion. And so this is us just trying to connect with you when we're doing this. So
that's all it is.
Yeah.
Like, comedy, when you break it, like, when you really look at it, like, under a microscope, it's a very strange profession. Like, we are essentially standing in front of a group of strangers, usually with a microphone, opening up, exposing ourselves, sometimes through comedic observation, sometimes through personal reflection. But it is, to an outsider, so fucking weird and foreign to them.
Yeah.
But I think to us, it's the most natural thing in the world.
It's so,
you know,
yeah.
And it, like I said, it is our way, the only way we really know how to connect with people.
Yeah.
Which sometimes I think is a detriment.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, like, I know in past relationships or when I was out on dates when I was single, I would
struggle, right? Yeah. Well, you would.
Well, sometimes I would struggle, and then my struggle would turn into, I would suddenly try to make a joke just to break the ice, whatever. And, you know, most of the time the women would look at me like, why are you?
Oh, yeah. Because our threshold and tolerance is so much further. And, like, we'll drop things, you know, say things, you know, edgy things socially, definitely not politically correct.
No.
Just definitely a freedom to it. And people are not always cool with that.
Have you ever had, like, an awkward moment on a date or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I told one girl a joke that wasn't mine. It was just a funny one-liner. And because people say, tell me a joke. And I'll be like, I'll tell you a joke. It's not mine. But if you're dumb enough to say something like that, I'll use somebody else's joke. Like, there's, you know, we all know comics that have great one-liners. And she was just not cool with it.
Do you remember what it was?
It was a joke by Matt Dwyer that said... And he says, when I was a child, I had an imaginary friend, but he wasn't allowed in the house because he was black. And I love it. I think it's hilarious. And he's got, you know, hundreds of them. And the girl was just too, she's young and she's just been plugged through the institution too much. She just got out of college. So people are crying racism at any, you know,
at
the drop of a hat. So she's like, well, that's right. And now she's, you know, older. I'm sure she'd be more educated and in the ways of the world. But anyway, that was one example. But it's yeah.
It's, I mean, it's but yeah, it I think in a way too, it alienates us from as you said, alienates us from connecting on a, because I've always said, like, I can go in front of a million people and be as comfortable as, you know, as anything.
Right.
But one-on-one, I'm nervous and I was like fumbling or whatever. And I think because of that, and because of, like you said, our, you know, sometimes our warped sense of humor, we do alienate ourselves when it comes to connecting on a one-on-one basis with some people.
I think that's right. I think comics are like, that's the show. That's me up there. Judge that.
Yeah.
And then let's go home and sleep together. Or let's be, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, or let, like, that's me. And this is, you're not supposed to see this side.
Exactly.
That's why we do that. So
exactly.
You don't have to see this.
So you don't see this.
Because we're letting very few people in, you know.
It's true.
Yeah.
Like, you're not dating anybody now.
No, not now. I've dated comics.
Have you dated
other people. Yeah. And it can be rough. It is rough, I got to say, as a male comic dating a female comic. You spend, you know, half your time worrying about your own set and more than half worrying about her set. Like, I would always worry more about how the girl did if we did the same show or whatever, because I think guys get over it a little bit quicker, hopefully, mm-hmm. ideally, 5-10 minutes, good or bad, okay, tomorrow's show. And for a woman up there on stage, very vulnerable, you know, physically, and, you know, because she can get bullied by hecklers, and, you know, as a person, emotionally, as a stand-up comic alone. So I really feel for a female comic, man, they're really opening themselves up, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to be sexist, but it's a man's world in comedy.
Yeah, still, yeah.
It really is. And, like, I appreciate the women that have come before and that are, like, you know, making it, like, good for them, absolutely. But, like, when you were dating these comics, Dimitri, did you ever find yourself in competition with them, or were you able to?
That's a great question. No, never in competition, weirdly. I don't know why. My brother was a great athlete, so I think at a young age I learned, like, oh, make yourself useful. Whatever helps the situation.
That's good.
So he was far superior, so it was, like, not a thing where I was like, oh, I have to get as many plaques or trophies as him. So there was never competition. And I don't know, maybe I had started earlier, so maybe I was further along. If I were maybe neck and neck with someone, it might be that way.
Yeah.
But that would be terrible. God, can you imagine? I mean, being in competition with your closest friend.
You know, for a while, I'm not sure if I even have ever mentioned this on the show, because Allison is on the show a lot too. Like, when Allison and I, when the first year of us dating, we'd already moved in together. And I remember she had gotten, like, somebody from New Wave Entertainment saw Allison at this random show, and they said, oh, you're great, come in, we want to meet with you, maybe do an album, blah, blah, blah. And I remember I was feeling this, like, this twinge of jealousy, I hate saying it, resentment. So I'm like, what the fuck, she's been doing it a year,
right
and I couldn't believe I was feeling that. And I told her, I said, look, I gotta tell you this, because if I don't, it's gonna eat me inside and I'm gonna take it out on you. And I opened up and I told her about it, and then like a day later, like after kind of almost emotionally vomiting that up, I realized that I can't be in competition with her, because we are so far from being the same kind of comic.
Oh, it's, yeah.
You know, not only is it a man and a woman thing, she's a a musical comic. I'm a monologist, blah, 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 blah. And that put me in my place to realize the dynamic that two of us have. And I was now, whenever, like, she got a voice in a movie and she did something for Showtime, and I am beyond the moon happy for her, you know? But I think a lot of, I've talked to a few other comics who do have that, like, that competitive thing with their partner. And it kills the relationship. Totally kills
it. Yeah, I can't imagine. That's just so much neediness.
It really is. It's comics that I think are not secure with themselves.
Yeah.
Can't accept somebody that's close to them getting the recognition that they're not getting at that time.
Right.
You know, and it's just, all it does is push them away.
God, that's
and
so...
keeps them in their own little bubble.
I mean, having said that, we both know Tom Segura and Christina Pasinski,
yeah.
who are married, and they make it work. And I asked her one, I'm like, how can you be married to a comic? And she said, how can you not be?
Yeah.
And I was like, all right.
No, you know what? Could not have said it better myself.
You know, duly noted.
Being married to a comic, like, it it, because here's number one, find any other girl who's not a comic that could understand what we do.
Right.
That could understand, oh, I got to be out on the road for 3 weeks, two of them on a cruise ship.
Right.
Name another girl that's going to be like, wait, true. What?
Yeah. You know? Unless she's a manager or an agent or something.
Right,
you know?
Somebody who's not in the business. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not going to.
Or another girl that can tolerate, you know, going out at midnight to do a spot for no money, you know, 20 miles away just to do it.
Right.
You know, somebody who's going to tolerate, you know, fucking making shit money, just striving, you know, for this dream, for this goal or whatever. Yeah. It's very tough to find somebody who could understand that. And that's why, ideally, I think somebody in the business is perfect for a comic.
Yeah. Wow.
Like what, and you don't have to get like specific, but like, what do you think didn't make it work with you in the comics?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that was more, that wasn't anything comedy related. I think that was just people, you know, relationships falling
clashing,
apart. Because what with comics, a lot of times you have people with sexual hangups, and I can't have that. But with, like, I've dated a few actresses, which is kind of the opposite. You have women, I mean, actors, actresses, artists, a little more experimental, a little more explorative than comics. So that's kind of fun. And I was with an improv sketch girl who is like hilarious, and I was like, this girl's funnier. Like, we'd go out and I'm like, I don't even need to talk because she's great socially, and then when we're one-on-one it's fine, but if we're at a party she can handle it, and then you know, I can do my shows and be funny there. I didn't feel the neediness, but I don't know what didn't work with.
So it had nothing to do with the business itself.
I don't think so.
It was more just relationships.
Yeah, I think it had run its course. I think, you know, I think it was.
That's good.
Yeah, so I think it's healthy, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
To get out.
Do you find yourself, like, in social situations more introverted?
You know, I thought I did, but then I saw other comics at parties that where they weren't comics, and I've had enough civilian friends meet comics that are just disaster areas. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not, just because I'm a comic, I'm not going to like sabotage myself and say, oh, I'm not good socially because I'm a comic, so I must not be. So I think I'm fine. I think I'm okay with that. I went to my high school in Orange County. It's very middle upper class, conservative, private, very social high school. Social calendar's full. You almost to graduate with a degree in like public communication because there's so many, like we had dances like weekly. It was a joke.
Oh wow.
And so you just naturally have this this kind of personality, you know, when we really should be studying whatever, math and history. But no, I don't, but I see some of those comics and they can be recluses, you know.
Yeah.
Like
I don't want to mention names, but I was recently at a club, and there was a comic that I was talking to, who really great comic, been around for a long, long time, but I would say he's got to be in his 50s by now, and he was he's not married, and he was broken up about his cat dying.
Oh boy.
And look, I've got cats. Yeah. I understand the connection to make with them, but like he was, you could tell like this was his child.
Wow.
You know, it's like the connection that normally we would really have strongly with a person, they had with a cat, and you could just, you kind of get the feeling like this guy doesn't get out that much.
Yeah.
And, you know, all he really has is comedy and cats, the cat, you know, CNC. Yeah. And it's like, you really kind of feel for the guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I hate saying this, but you look at him going, God, I hope that never is me.
Right.
You know?
Oh, God.
Like, that's another, when I started, there were guys that, and I remember this guy specifically, I was working with him, one of my first road gigs in, somewhere in Central Florida. It was like a two-nighter weekend gig. And I remember this guy, we were at the pool, and he was saying like a, like it's almost like out of a movie. Ah, yeah, I remember. I was working in Vegas. Leonard was opening for me, and then I met this bitch, and I fucking married her, and she broke my heart. I must have been like 23 or so, and I remember looking, going, I will never be this guy. This is my goal is to never
to not be this. That's
guy.
So good that we see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, not that I will never work a weekend gig. You know, if I have the time and whatever, just for shits and giggles, but I will not be the bitter fucking comic.
No.
That's what I never want to aspire to, never want to end up as. you know, or the recluse comic.
Yeah. That's a huge thing. That's so important for us to see. That's what I think is good about us seeing, coming into it now and seeing it, because I think so many of those guys that were in the 80s, early 90s were like, where's my sitcom? Where's my, you know, and they just all expected it kind of weirdly. Whereas now I do, as delusional as a lot of people are that are starting now, I think they are realistic about, like, okay, I've got to create my own way here, whether it's an internet series or whether it's a Twitter account or whatever.
It's a completely different world now. Like, back in the 80s, there was no social media. There was no internet. You know, it was, like, getting seen in the clubs, doing that one Tonight Show spot that just got you the series or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of comics, like, and again, I'll admit this freely, when I started, I saw the business still as that. Mm-hmm. And then couple years in, everything started changing.
Yeah.
It took me a little while to realize, like, okay, it's not going to be like that.
You know,
it's time to change.
I thought gears. One or two late night spots, and you're on your way.
Yeah,
and we have guys with 20, 30 late night spots that you never heard of.
It's true.
They're not, well, we've heard of them, but they're not a household name.
Yeah. They're not, which is just amazing. It really is. And even in the clubs, you'd think like some decent late night spots or credits will get you in a lot easier, even up the money a little bit. Doesn't help.
Yeah,
really doesn't help.
I don't know. It's a lot of things, right? It's people's. There's so much they can do now. They can TiVo any show. They can watch anything online. So why would they come see a live show? I don't know if decent people go to comedy clubs. It seems like, you know, there's a lot of crass acts, and gross language isn't going to ever spoil any, like. Comedian's never going to criticize a comic for being graphic. They'll criticize him for being not funny.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Robert Schimmel was graphic, but nobody says, oh, he's a graphic blue comic. They say he was a phenomenal comic. Yeah, and then you're like, oh, yeah, but he was dirty. I forgot he was dirty because he's so funny, you forget about it.
That's, like, Schimmel packaged it perfectly.
Yeah.
I would always describe Schimmel as being, like, that dirty uncle that you'd have that would tell you some, you know, some off-color jokes. But he was charming and lovable.
Oh, yeah.
And... not sure. Did you ever meet him?
I got to work with him once, so it was great. He's clean cut, got the sport coat, nice, doesn't drink, doesn't do drugs.
No.
You know?
He was I'd become very friendly with him. Like, I'd work with him a lot and whatever, and the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And it broke my heart.
Oh, when, yeah. After when all he went through. Away. Yeah.
And still, I'm not sure if you heard what's going on now.
I just know that his brother in the documentary is they're going to maybe make something, or he's trying to raise money for that. I don't know.
Oh, really? I didn't even know about that.
Yeah. So
there's some bullshit going on with his estate.
Oh,
I wouldn't even get into that now. Yeah. But yeah, Schimmel, like you said, he was dirty,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term. He wasn't vulgar. He just talked about honest stuff,
right.
And a lot of it had to do with, you know, sex.
Yeah.
Just honest. He was almost like Louis C.K. with his honesty, but with a little bit of, I'm trying to think of somebody offhand. I can't. Just Louis C.K., just with more of a laid-back charm.
Yeah. A little more, more charm and the...
and just
and the sport coat and the old school. Like, my grandparents were clean cut people that, you know, served in the military, you know, raised a lot of kids in the Midwest, went to church every Sunday, but they loved the film. They loved Red Fox. They loved Joan Rivers. They loved Buddy Hackett. And that's what Schimmel was. He was like, he could get away with that stuff. Your parents could go see him say the things that Louis C.K. says, but, you know, Louis's not doing it in a tight black t-shirt with his stomach hanging out and but jeans that are sagging down. He's like, you know, even though, you know, that's his style.
But
Schimmel, yeah, you're right. Schimmel could get away with it and execute.
And still make, and but still come across as just friendly.
You'd have him over. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. By the way, speaking of old school guys who are filthy, this is part of the show, Patrick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Called the Skippy Green Show.
Oh, Skippy Green. I was hoping he'd come in today.
It's the Skippy Green Show.
Patrick Keane, how are you?
Skippy. Oh, cool. I didn't know you were on the cruise with us.
Are you kidding me? I'm a cruise comic. I was on the Amistad.
Jesus.
I was on the Titanic.
Oh, gee. Oh, okay. Did you get the light on that?
Did I get the light?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, actually, I got the lifeboats. I got off. I was a fucking Molly Brown. Let me tell you, unsinkable my ass. That bitch went down. If you know what I mean. All right.
Skippy, man.
So, Patrick, yes. Here's how this works. I'm going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
And you got to answer the question in 10 words exactly. Not 11, not 9, 10 words. Are you ready? No, that's not the question.
Okay, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready for the 10-word answer.
If you could fuck any old school comic, who would it be and why? 10 words.
Martha Ray?
Eight more.
Because?
Seven more. Take all the time you want, sirs.
Yes. Martha Ray, because of her... self-deprecating...
I was kidding about taking all the time you want.
Oh, self-deprecating and sexual
that's
style.
Well, that's 11, but we'll...
Oh, okay, self-deprecating. Okay, yeah, because of her self-deprecating and sexual style, I think. It was because she was like a Rodney Dangerfield, but female. So I've just exceeded way beyond 10, but...
Worst answer I've ever heard.
Yeah, right. But did you ever have sex with her in the old days, or...
With Martha Ray?
Yeah, yeah.
Put it this way.
Oh, shit, am I thinking of the right chick?
Oh, you thought Martha Ray was a Broadway actress. You realize that, right?
Oh, shit. You know what I'm thinking of is... she was on the Scooby-Doo cartoons.
Phyllis Diller?
Phyllis Diller is who I'm thinking of, with the sharp chin and the nose.
Yeah,
and, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Completely different cunt right there.
Yeah, yeah. Phyllis,
you know,
Diller.
It's funny you mentioned that. 1952. I'm having a barbecue for my place for some of the biggest names in comedy. Everybody's there. And yeah. I'm on the grill. I'm doing the food. Everybody's raving about it. Cut to 2 hours later. I'm teabagging Phyllis Diller.
No, oh my God.
And I start to chuckle because I realize that I'm a killer griller diller filler. I mean, really, what are the odds?
Oh, man, you've seen it all, man. I mean, oh, God. Well, yeah, she would be mine. I mean, even after this story, that just makes her more attractive. So, my compliments, man.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
It's the Skippy Green Show.
Pat, thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to see you guys. I didn't know Skippy was going to come.
Skippy,
so that's
great. A surprise.
Yeah.
Surprise.
So.
Where can people find you?
I think on the Twitter at Citizen Keen.
KEANE.
Perfect.
Citizen Keen on Twitter. Do you have a website? Or?
Yeah, it's citizenkeen.com.
Perfect. Tour dates, everything on there?
Yeah, that's all up there. And then Facebook, everything's it's up and running. So,
excellent,
yeah.
Man. And you're going to be back on the Norwegian, right, in July?
Yeah, I'll be in the Norwegian Getaway in July, circling the Bahamas, I guess.
Excellent.
So I'll be here all month.
Excellent. Well, I'm not sure exactly when this show's going up, but you guys can always check my site, flipisfunny.com, for tour dates. I know I'll be back in the Norwegian Getaway, April 5th through the 19th. Allison will be with me, too, not performing, just hanging out. So if you happen to be on the ship, come say hi. And, of course, whatsfordinnerpodcast.com, at Flip Schultz on Twitter, at WFDpodcast on Twitter. All the CDs, all of my CDs, including Skippy Green CD, available on iTunes. Thanks so much, guys. And we're going to enjoy the rest of our cruise. And I hope you guys are enjoying the rest of your day. Dinner. See you later. Bye-bye.
What's for dinner?
Talking about what's ever on their minds. Talking about what's ever on their minds. Talking about what's ever on their minds.